This is Bloomberg Business Week. I'm Carol Masser.
And I'm Bloomberg Quick Takes' Tim Stenovek. We're here every day bringing you the latest news from the worlds of business and finance.
Plus technology, politics, economics, all harnessing the power of Business Week reporters and editors.
Not to mention our 2,700 journalists and analysts in more than 120 countries.
You can download Bloomberg Business Week on iTunes, SoundCloud, or Bloomberg.com.
You can also listen to our radio show at 2 p.m. Eastern Time on Bloomberg Radio.
Or watch us on YouTube. Search Bloomberg Global News. It's the Sooner Than You Think issue of Bloomberg Businessweek magazine, showcasing technology, really actionable insight into the near future of business and the market forces and tech innovations that really are already transforming our global economy. There is a theme, Tim, among some of the stories about scarcity, and that includes the domestic cover story about the goblin in the batteries.
Yeah, scarcity of broadband, scarcity of water, and scarcity of cobalt that we need for batteries. We're talking cobalt now. Joel Weber is editor of Bloomberg Businessweek. He's with us in the Bloomberg Interactive Brokers studio. And Drake Bennett is technology reporter at Bloomberg Businessweek. He joins us on the phone from New York City. Joel, I was not thinking about cobalt when I plugged my phone in yesterday, but I certainly
Shame
was.
Shame on you.
And yet that phone, cobalt helps make it run. And, you know, this is our domestic cover story for the Sooner Than You Think issue. And I think one of the things that we were wrestling with, and, you know, as consumers, we actually wrestle with this all the time, and we're going to wrestle with it a whole lot more in the years to come. But ultimately, like, charging, right, and batteries. And you think about your phone and what makes that go, it's, you know, it's batteries. And as we look at this energy transition, where we're going to see millions more electric vehicles on the roads around the world, there's a question about how those batteries are actually gonna run.
Right.
And cobalt is really the secret ingredient. And so Drake's done this story. It is sort of magical because of these two narratives that it brings together. It's really the search for a better battery. On one hand, that might come from the ground, and we need more cobalt. But it also could come from the lab and might not involve any cobalt. So Drake, why don't you break that down for us?
Yeah, no, thanks, Joel. Yeah, exactly. I mean, I think we think about batteries as technologies, and they are technologies. I mean, they're closer to being like a microchip than they are to being like a commodity like oil. So it makes sense that you see these dramatic drops in price and these increases in energy density and things like that. But they're very dependent on the particular, you know, chemical characteristics of particular elements. And one of those is cobalt. Cobalt is particularly good as a cathode material, as sort of making the sort of foundation of one of the electrodes of the battery. And there are, you know, most of the world cobalt happens to be found under the Democratic Republic of Congo, which is, you know, unstable country, very poor working conditions in the mines. Chinese companies own a lot of the mines there, and so there's, you know, incentive right there to try to diversify our supply. But on top of that, you know, if we are going to meaningfully make a dent, in, you know, if there's 1.2 billion internal combustion cars on the road today, if we're going to switch some meaningful proportion of those to being electric vehicles, we're going to need many times more cobalt than what we currently know about. So there's two approaches that I look at. One is finding more. So there's a tech company based in Silicon Valley. It's these physicists and data scientists who are convinced that they can use the tools of data science, these powerful artificial intelligence algorithms, to find deposits where traditional energy companies and traditional exploration geologists have failed.
And you went to one of those.
I did. I spent a lot of time talking to these guys, and then as it happened, they were just beginning to go see if they're right. So they were one of their exploration claim blocks is in the Canadian Arctic, way up at the very tip of Quebec. And I went up there and spent some time flying around in a helicopter with one of their geologists as he went to these spots that this AI was saying looked promising and examine the rock. Yeah, it's kind of primitive, actually, seeing what he did. He had this sledgehammer, and he just break off these rocks and then get up this kind of jeweler's loop and look at them. And, you know,
not very high tech.
But, yeah, very high tech. I mean, he did have a you know, Samsung tablet that he was entering stuff into. But it is this mix of this kind of, you know, very traditional geology and these tools that rely on enormous amounts of computing power and advanced data science.
So after reporting out this story, Drake, are your sources optimistic that there is a solution out there? Because I think about something like this and the transition to electric vehicles, and I don't think that consumers understand that this isn't black and white, right? These batteries take serious natural resources, and even to charge at this point takes fossil fuels in many cases.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, the other sort of side of the coin that I wrote about was a chemist who's basically trying to design batteries that don't need cobalt at all. So then it doesn't matter that it's all under the Congo and that we don't know where we're going to get it. And I think, you know, there's ways in which these two approaches are in tension, but in many ways they're complementary. And so I think, and there's, you know, plenty of other folks who are looking at recycling or, you know, improving the kind of processing of these ores so that you can use more marginal deposits. And so there's a bunch of approaches, and I think you put those together and you are probably going to make a meaningful dent in this problem.
I mean, having seen both sides of maybe how this plays out, what's your conclusion about what ultimately will happen in terms of batteries? No cobalt, or we'll find more?
I think both. I think we'll find more. I think it, you know, they're interesting, you know, examples from history, you know, oil and gas, right? There was this idea that we had reached peak oil 40 years ago, and, right, you know, that didn't happen. But at the same time, you are already seeing this process where the amount of cobalt being used in these batteries is getting lower and lower and lower. So, you know, whether or not it goes to zero, it's still gone from basically 100% in the first lithium ion batteries to, you know, 5-10% in some of the things being built now.
And I think see all combination of it, yeah, right? To, like, you know, we're talking about changes that are going to play out over years.
Yeah.
Even right, for, you know, best case scenario, this place that Drake visited, if that became a operational mine, you know, it could take a decade before anything from that ground ends up actually powering a car, you know?
Yeah.
So massive infrastructure we're talking about that goes into some of these projects. So it's a little bit of everything, I think.
It's an incredible story, and you really, you know, get into the nitty gritty of what's going on, and something that I think we take for granted, safe to say.
Well, and I think there's this misconception that I was alluding to earlier that it's immediately a green solution for someone to go buy an electric car. But when it comes to the production of it, when it comes to the battery, when it comes to charging, it's not that simple.
Great issue, Joel.
Well, there's much more in there, and I think one of the through lines is looking at resources, and in this case, it's a battery, but you know, there's this water one that I think is also really interesting, and, you know, look, a lot of these problems are things that humans create, and now we get to try and solve them, and boy, I hope we're good at innovation still.
Yeah.
Fingers crossed. Everything's crossed.
I mean, still can't believe there are 120 million Americans who don't have access to broadband, which is another story. We talked about that one yesterday on the show.
All of that in our weekend Bloomberg Business Week show that you can catch on Bloomberg Radio at 8 a.m. And of course, check out the magazine. It is on newsstands. Check out Bloomberg.com, Businessweek.com, and the Bloomberg Terminal. Our thanks to Drake Bennett and Businessweek editor Joel Weber. This is Bloomberg.
This is Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Masser and Bloomberg Quick Takes Tim Stenovic on Bloomberg Radio.
All right, you are listening to Bloomberg Business Week. Several headlines when it comes, certainly, to COVID and the vaccines and boosters. In fact, we are awaiting some news from the CDC's Advisory Committee on Immunization Practice, making its own recommendations about who should receive additional doses. We know Pfizer getting a step forward. The FDA saying people over the age of 65 and adults at high risk of severe COVID-19 who already got that Pfizer-BioNTech vaccine can get a booster shot. But there's a lot of information that still has to happen.
A lot of concern about, okay, are we to a point where we need to be encouraging boosters when there are so many holdouts for just getting that first shot?
Exactly. So let's see what Dr. Andy Pekosh has to say. He's professor of molecular microbiology and immunology at Johns Hopkins University, Bloomberg School of Public Health. Of course, that school is supported by Michael R. Bloomberg, founder of Bloomberg LP and Bloomberg Philanthropies. Dr. Pekosh back with us on the phone from Baltimore. Dr. Pekosh, how are you?
Oh, I'm doing great. Thanks for having me on the show.
Always good to check in with you. Where are you on boosters at this point?
It's important to note that the boosters are going to be designed just to help the very susceptible parts of the population increase their immunity and to keep them out of the hospital or suffering from severe disease. We heard that from the FDA last week. I've been listening in on the CDC, and that's really an ongoing theme. So boosters are going to be for to keep people out of the hospital. And for the short term, they'll be focused on individuals who got the Pfizer vaccine initially. But don't be surprised if you hear similar things coming for Moderna and for Johnson & Johnson in the next coming weeks, because those companies are just a few weeks behind Pfizer in terms of submitting their paperwork to the FDA and the CDC.
Dr. Pekosh, where do you think we are as a country when it comes to the Delta variant and the most recent wave that we've seen? Because there is some chatter, especially in recent days, that has indicated that some people who are doing modeling are saying the worst could be behind us.
I think we've seen Delta make its first sweep through the population.
Ooh, I don't like the sound of that.
It did it in the summer and at times when, you know, the virus isn't supposed to be spreading as easily. So the only caveat that I have to this is, you know, we really have to see how things are going to work out now as kids are back in school, as more people are back in the workplace, as we're moving indoors into environments that's easier for the virus to spread.
The one pushback I would have to that, and correct me if I'm wrong, but didn't it spread in places that were really warm where people would be gathering inside anyway?
Absolutely. And that's why I worry that when we get into even better conditions for the virus, that the spread may kick up a little bit. I'm certainly optimistic right now. I do think the worst is behind us with Delta. I think we're seeing the vaccines are holding their own against Delta. And so I'm confident that we'll have not as bad a fall as we have seen in the summer.
So worse behind us, but it doesn't mean that it doesn't continue to remind us that we're still in a pandemic, that we still have to be careful.
And this is where the boosters shouldn't distract us from the real goal of reducing cases by vaccinating the unvaccinated, because that's where we're going to really be able to turn the corner on this pandemic. We need to get more people vaccinated. Because that's going to reduce virus spread, that's going to reduce case numbers, it's going to let us get rid of some of these public health interventions that we have to have right now, because even though we've got vaccinated people, the virus is spreading so broadly and so strongly in the population that we need more than just the vaccines to protect us.
What is the best way to get those people who, even up to now, when vaccines have been available for months and the incentives have been there, and now we're seeing mandates. How do you get those holdouts to get vaccinated?
Yeah, I really feel that there's a good portion of the population that just hears all the rhetoric and really is just a little confused and a little bit taken aback and is not sure which way to go, because the misinformation can be just as loud as the positive information. So it really comes down to communication and redoubling our efforts and the efforts of public health officials to make those more personal connections, those small group connections. I've had a lot of success talking to people in groups of two or three here at Johns Hopkins University, talking to small groups in webinars that we advertise over Twitter, making those kind of conversations so that individuals can really have that one-on-one with you and understand the sincerity in which you're passing along this really fantastic information about how safe and efficacious these vaccines are. It's hard work.
Yeah, and getting the right information is so crucial to getting us through this in the right way. Hey, having said that, I've got a little bit of a sore left arm. Tim, I think, maybe had a sore arm.
A couple weeks ago.
We got our flu shots. What do we need to keep in mind when it comes to, you know, the normal flu season, which kind of didn't really happen during the pandemic because we were all sheltering in place?
Yeah, I think this year we're really keeping our eye on influenza. The public health interventions really did a great job of limiting viruses like influenza, even common cold viruses. For kids, a virus called RSV, or respiratory syncytial virus, all those viruses were really reduced during the pandemic. Now we're seeing some of these public health interventions relaxed, and we've already seen a really big increase in rhinoviruses, the common cold virus. We're seeing a large increase in respiratory syncytial virus in kids. And those two things usually mean that we'll see influenza over the next couple of weeks. So the vaccine is important to get this year more than ever because we've gone some period of time without seeing a lot of influenzas. There's a lot of susceptibility in the population because we haven't had infections coming through the population. And in particular, this is important for younger populations because they're the most vulnerable. They haven't seen influenza. Many of them haven't gotten a lot of influenza vaccines. And it's that population that we really want to pay attention to during the next couple of weeks.
Get your flu shots.
Exactly.
Not too early.
No, not at all. Dr. Andy Pekosh, thank you so much. Professor of Molecular Microbiology and Immunology at Johns Hopkins University, Bloomberg School of Public Health, supported by Michael R. Bloomberg, founder of Bloomberg LP and Bloomberg Philanthropies.
This is Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Masser and Bloomberg Quick Takes' Tim Stenovic on Bloomberg Radio.
We're going to zero in on the Walt Disney Company. It's been, Tim, actually in the news a lot this week. The stock moving as a result, sometimes down, sometimes up. Writing about the company in a Bloomberg Opinion piece is our own Tim O'Brien, senior columnist at Bloomberg Opinion, right next to us in our Interactive Brokers Group. So good to be with you.
So good to be here.
So tell us about Disney, because they've been in the news a lot. Bob Chapek talking a bunch this week.
Well, Disney's wrestling with a lot of stuff at theme parks and the entertainment industry. But what I zoomed in on was its increasingly close embrace with sports betting. Disney is the most...
Wait, what?
Sports betting, that's right. And this is a family-centric company.
Right.
Sports betting has been booming. The Supreme Court in 2018 basically broke up Nevada's monopoly on sports betting. They knocked down federal laws that prevented other states from adopting it. And you wed that to the internet era, where everyone can gamble on their phones or... through their televisions in their living rooms, and it is ubiquitous. It's growing. A lot of the pure play sports betting companies have seen their market caps explode from $2 billion to $24 billion over a two-year period, and younger men do it, and Disney wants to connect to those people. And what other property does Disney have that younger men and younger women too, mm-hmm. but it tilts towards male? It's ESPN, the powerhouse sports network. And now ESPN is forming, it already has partnerships with companies that provide the odds. If you turn into any ESPN broadcast, you now see what once was anomalous, sports betting lines on your TV screen. But now Disney's pondering possibly licensing deals where there would actually be bookmaking shops that have the ESPN brand on it.
It feels so like un-Disney.
Right. I mean, how does the company wrestle with this? This is a family values focused company. We talk about casinos. These are, sin stocks that are in the same bucket as tobacco companies in some cases.
Well,
you think of off-track betting, right? And the image that conjures.
Right. Historically, Bob Iger wrestled with this. Now, Bob Chapek is, what they have said is, we would never fully bring sports gambling inside the ESPN model, meaning, I guess, that you couldn't, you couldn't gamble directly through any ESPN properties. But they're offering then to sort of have outside companies handle the gambling and the bet, and they'll just take a licensing fee. And both of them, Bob Iger said a version of that a couple years ago. Bob Chapek, who succeeded him just this week at a Goldman conference, said we would never embed gambling in our products, but our audience likes it. Our users like it.
Yeah.
And frankly, cable TV, it's fraying around the edges. Streaming is where it's at. And sports gambling is a hook into a younger audience.
You could so see it, though, because of ESPN and all their coverage, that it would be so easy to embed it in, right? If you think about it. Tell us about Adam Schefter.
Adam Schefter is an axe. He is the senior NFL insider on ESPN. His stock and trade is breaking all sorts of news and minutiae and gossipy news you can use about trades and injuries and starting lineups, the kind of stuff that sports fanatics really feast upon.
Right.
He's got a massive Twitter following, 8.2 million followers. He also is now investing alongside Bob Kraft, the owner of the New England Patriots, in a little gambling startup. Hmm. And
how is that okay?
Well, I called up ESPN and I said, do you folks have an ethics policy or guidelines about how your employees invest outside the company? And they said, we won't comment on that. as to whether they had a policy or whether Schefter violated. Because the issue here is, if you see him speaking on screen going forward, is he talking his book, so to speak? If he's got an investment in a gambling company, is he offering unfiltered and objective information when he's a broadcaster on ESPN?
So we don't know if they're going to be putting up a disclosure, if he's going to talk about a disclosure. We don't know if he got a special exemption to. I would imagine it's, you know, this is ABC we're talking about. They probably have rules in place.
They ain't saying, Tim.
Wow.
They ain't saying.
Maybe, you know, if you have 8.2 million, if you have 8.2 million Twitter followers, then, you know, you can kind of do what you want.
I also sort of wonder if they were, you know, maybe they didn't know he had this investment. It was just disclosed this week. Who knows what he told his bosses? But he, as an individual, if, you know, if his relationship to viewers is, I'm giving you pure information that helps you enjoy the game more, and then there's a group of gamblers who are like, well, that also helps us make money more.
And, right. And that's what it's ultimately about, right? I mean, Disney trying to figure out what is the Disney of the future and how do you create new revenue streams.
Correct.
So this coming at a time when investors are a little concerned about the growth of Disney Plus. We saw that play out in recent days. Would this be happening, Tim, this investment be happening, do you think, if we wouldn't see the decline of traditional pay TV, traditional cable TV, just in 30 seconds?
Sports betting is booming, so it might have happened anyway, but they get the added two-for-one benefit of also addressing some of their audience concerns.
Do you think it would have happened if Bob Iger was still there?
Possibly.
Oh, okay. So that they, you know, were certainly considering it. Yeah. Good stuff. So great to have you come back.
Thanks for having me here.
Love it, love it. Tim O'Brien, senior columnist at Bloomberg Opinion. I wonder if Adam Schefter got called to the office. Adam Schefter, could you come to the ESPN office?
Hey, we'll see how
could you tell us about
too.
This company?
I need a tip.
Exactly. Check out Tim on Twitter at Tim O'Brien. Of course, Bloomberg Opinion, senior columnist in our Interactive Broker studio.
I'm driving in my car. I turn on the radio.
How about you let me drive?
Oh, no.
Who's gonna drive you home?
Honey, please, I'll do the driving.
Drive on.
Excuse me, I want to drive.
Just drive, baby.
It's the question that drives us.
This is the Drive to the Close.
That funky music will drive us till the dawn.
On Bloomberg Radio.
Yes, indeed. Just about 10 minutes left in today's trading session. So just a few minutes to wrap up that Thursday trade. We are hovering near our best levels of the session. So as Charlie mentioned, really seeing some decent gains, 1.3% higher on the S&P, 1.5% higher on the Dow.
And up, I think 1.1%. That's more than decent. Do you?
It's not decent if you're shorting the market, because you'd be like, I'd love to see a little bit of selling.
Well, you saw some on Monday.
We did. But we've made back that ground in a big way. Doug Cioka is CEO and partner at Kavar Capital Partners, $1 billion in assets under management. Back with us from Leawood, Kansas. Doug, how are you?
I am great. How about you guys?
Doing well. It's been another, I hate to use the word interesting, we overuse it, but, you know, there was fear in the markets on Monday. I was reading something about J.P. Morgan, who was talking about fund flows, ETF flows out on Monday, about $11 billion, which was, I think, the biggest on a down day this year outside of quarterly options and futures expirations. And then here we are, a rally, and we've bounced back significantly. How do you see the internals of the market? Is it fragile? Is it confident? Is it strong? What do you see?
I think it's more confident than it is fragile. It may be a little tired, right? I think it might be calm but not complacent. And to your point, Carol, I mean, you're coming into this week off of a down week and a really bad Friday, which was a quadruple witching Friday.
Right.
And you kind of had this trifecta of fear that was percolating over the weekend. Obviously, the Evergrande news and the prospects of it having the capability to catalyze a global credit event, given kind of its precarious lending position. You had the Fed meeting, right, timing and intensity of whatever tapering or tightening communication they were going to provide. All the nausea, as was just mentioned in that Bloomberg Opinion piece, preceding our segment, of these political debates domestically, debt ceiling concerns, all the bureaucratic bundling and continuing resolutions, and throwing a fourth deal, right, is seasonality, which seems to be getting a lot of time and attention, and was even typified in some of the fund flows that I read that you'd mentioned about J.P. Morgan earlier this week. So if you have all of those things, right, you go into a market that becomes incredibly oversold, right? After the Monday down day, and it was down 1,000 points, about 40 minutes to go, and massive futures buying came in, and then everyone hoped for this turnaround Tuesday, and that fell flat. But then ultimately, the Fed comes out and I think threads the needle yesterday and injects more optimism back into the market that carried through yesterday afternoon and all of today.
Hey, I just want to go back to Evergrande because is the market telling us that this is not going to be a global credit event?
I think the market is telling us that, Tim, and I think a few things, right? Why would we fear Evergrande? And I think it's not so much from a Lehman-like credit catastrophe, but more from a consumer demand destruction in the U.S. and Europe and a business demand destruction prospects in other parts of the world, right? China's financial system is still in many respects closed, but is the impact of the purchasing power of those that are most adversely impacted over in China that could ripple through the global economy. I actually read an awesome article. I think it's going to be the cover story for next week's Bloomberg Business Week edition. It takes a really deep dive on the evolution of Evergrande, its prospects for recovery.
Yeah, it's our international cover, actually, this week.
So the best line I thought of the whole article was, you know, Chinese leaders speak of the goals of moderate prosperity and common prosperity, and households accumulating more debt to buy multiple or luxurious homes doesn't sync with that vision.
Right.
I thought that was fascinating, right? Ultimately, it's hard to square communism and capitalism, and I think the market created a lot of volatility trying to piece those together.
So dips. When are dips buying opportunities, and when are dips a sign of the beginning of a correction?
Yeah, you know, I think, and I actually keep taped on one of my screens at work, my main man of all time, Peter Lynch, and he had said more people have lost money anticipating corrections than in the actual correction. And I think we need to adhere to that, considering time in the market, not timing the market. However.
But you know what
however,
I mean. Come
however,
on, we can
hold
be
on, there's
smart.
A however, there's a however here.
Right, exactly.
Right. I mean, the right now there's just so much cash. And we've actually done a deeper dive. And what does that mean? Everyone talks about cash on the sidelines. Well, where is this cash? And where are these sidelines? Well, there is a lot of money that is looking to find an entry point. And, you know, this is the first 5% pullback we've had in a year. Maybe that speaks to the seasonality impact. It was not on a closing low, but an intraday low. We saw 5.2% pullback September 21st. Last one was a 9.5% in September of 2020. So you have a lot of cash, you have low interest rates, and Jay Powell just said yesterday they're going to stay low for a while. That's heartening for risk assets. And then you have market multiples that are improving, right? So you have an S&P that's up 17-18% for the year, and it's selling at a lower, a cheaper multiple than it did in the first of the year. So for people that are concerned about a dip turning into a correction, you need to typically have earnings rolling over and a Fed policy mistake. And I don't know how we have a mistake, because we're going to have the most telegraphed and transparent Fed move in history the next time the Fed actually
moves. Agreed. I mean, they basically are, I keep saying this, but they are spoon-feeding us. And
yeah.
To be fair, Mike McKee said, Jay Powell did a great job yesterday. I mean, the markets kind of got it, understood it, and are off and running.
I agree. I mean, I think they've done a good job for quite a while, Carol, but yet it seems that, like, ahead of every meeting, there emerges this deep-seated fear that Powell is going to disclose some, like, alternate agenda or suggest that his open market committee has overtaken his influence and the market's going to left to ascertain what that all means. But he's doing everything he can, in my opinion, to thread that needle between stimulating the economy and not provoking hyperinflation. And it's a real-time experiment or exercise, but again, the transparency is I think, a big asset for him.
All right. Any nervousness out there? Just got about 30
Always.
Seconds left. Always.
Oh, gosh, of course. I mean, and we talked about this a couple months ago. Our challenge right now in sourcing client or investing client capital is in fixed income.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I mean, you know that it's impossible to predict the returns in the credit markets over the next 20 years that we saw in the last 20. So
right. We're
spending a lot of time there, and of course that makes us nervous. Absolutely.
All right. We're going to leave it there. Always good to check in with you. Be well. Doug Sciocca, he is CEO and partner at Kavar Capital Partners, $1 billion in assets under management, joining us once again on the phone from Leawood, Kansas.
Thanks for listening to Bloomberg Business Week. Download the podcast on iTunes, SoundCloud, or Bloomberg.com.
And you can also listen to our radio show at 2 p.m. Eastern on Bloomberg Radio or watch us on YouTube. Search Bloomberg Global News.